You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
For example, when this car gets to the corner, it's supposed to stop so that this car can drive right on through. But accidents happen.
Welcome to episode 211 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by DJ Valentine from Simplistic Reviews to discuss a 1976 film based on a novel written by the same man that brought us Death Wish. Starring Charlton Heston, James Coburn, Barbara Hershey, and Michael Parks... Directed by Andrew V. McLaglen, it's The Last Hard Men. But first...
Today, a lot of you are thinking about...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield. And sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
We've brought back those good old time flavors, and today they're better than ever. All these delicious treats are waiting for you at the refreshment stand. Delicious fresh popcorn, ice cold cola, tasting candy you know and love. They're all ready for you now, so you won't have to miss any of the feature. Come and get them.
There are words men live by, words of strength, of wisdom, and of peace. We urge you to find the spiritual comfort and guidance we all so greatly need by attending your place of worship regularly.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Now and again, the West produces a man who stands apart from the crowd. Noble as the valleys, rugged as the rocks. A man of action who makes an unforgettable impact. Joe Lightcloud is such a man.
Joe coming home? Joe coming home!
But home ain't gonna be the same. They're still picking up the pieces from the last time. When Joe's home, times are wild and hilarious.
You gotta get to know each other better.
Oh, you mean like that?
Wonder how long the fight'll last.
Long enough, baby.
Mama!
I can explain everything.
Oh, I forgot to warn you about that.
Start the ceremony.
I gotta run.
Isn't Joe coming in?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I can't stay.
Head for Altas, Joe.
Mama! Baby dear, don't you want to be good?
How am I going to be good if I never get any practice?
I want to thank you all for a delightful afternoon.
You got a lot of guts, lady.
The winding string. And the winds that blow ask me how can you stay away.
There's never been anyone like rioters, rip-roaring, rollicking Joe.
And now, on with the show.
Why didn't you send for me?
Well, Captain, I thought about it.
Well, maybe you should have thought about it a little harder, Sheriff.
Well, maybe. When's the last time you spent a day in the saddle?
You think I forgot how to ride a damn horse?
I didn't say it now, but when?
That statehood rally a year ago.
Yeah, I remember that. That's about the day before you put yourself out to pasture, wasn't it?
That's right. I put myself just like I put you in that chair. Now, Sheriff, I know I'm retired from the territorial police, but damn it, you tell me who's with him.
This come in about 6 o'clock.
Well, it's 22 escaped, and they captured or killed 15 of them, so that leaves 7.
Cats. No. Weed. He could track a duck across a pond. Sure has the knife. Leroy Tucker. That coyote sniffed under every boulder in the territory. Mike Shelby, 19 years old, in for life. Menendez. That must be Caesar Menendez. Yeah. Real handsome looking man. Cut the head off a little gal in Nogales one time. Said he wanted her earrings.
And Zach Provo.
I thought he was dead.
Yeah, well, he will be soon enough. You know, I got a pretty good bunch of boys over in Yuma.
Pretty good. For Zach Provo, that ain't good enough. Yeah, you don't know. It was a little before your time. That half-breed, meanest Injun I ever saw. 10 years I chased him up and down the territory. First time I tried to take him, he plumb outdrew me. Left me for dead. Gut shot. I never knew a man could be so fast. Last time, though, he wasn't fast enough. Caught him clean.
You should have killed him.
Christ knows I tried.
Now, don't you worry about it, Sam. We'll get him. Hell, we got automobile, telegraph, railroad. I ain't made anybody outrun the telephone yet. The Army tells me next year gonna have some of them flying machines. You know that, Sam?
Flying machines? No, you said it just now, the railroads. Zach Provo caught himself a ride out of Yuma.
Yep. I'm way ahead of you on that, Sam. They're checking on every car and every train. They got dogs.
Oh, he's in the water. He was, anyway. Yeah. Let's see, the Gila. It's too low this time of year. The Colorado, but current's too strong to go north. No. He drifted down the Gila into Yuma and caught a train.
First train from Yuma's due, and you've got about 15 minutes to make it.
Get up! Can I get that new fire engine? Get every deputy you can find. You coming, Captain?
Yeah, I believe I will.
Okay, our movie this time is The Last Hard Men from 1976. And joining me to discuss this film is DJ Valentine from Simplistic Reviews. DJ, welcome back to the show.
Oh, pleasure having me back on. I'm all geared up for Super Bowl Sunday, and I don't know if I'm supposed to, you know, date this recording, but yes, I'm all psyched up. I'm happy to talk this movie.
This will come out a few weeks after the fact, but it's fine to mention that we are actually squeezing this recording in the little bit of time we have
Taylor
before
Swift
the Super Bowl.
Taylor Swift and the Kansas City Chiefs have just won the Super Bowl. we just saw it. It was amazing.
Now, see, I live in Broncos territory, so we are supposed to not root for the Chiefs. You know, that's...
The San Francisco 49ers and John Harbaugh have just won the Super Bowl. Unbelievable. I don't know how they just came back out of nowhere. It's unbelievable. Taylor Swift was crying. It's fantastic. It's fantastic stuff.
See, I always say the Super Bowl is the only football game I watch all year, and I only watch it for the commercials, and even more so for the movie trailers.
I'm a Dolphin fan, so it's also the only football game I watch all year. Because we usually suck, so...
Well, before we get too far here, please remind everybody about who you are and what you do over there at Simplistic Reviews.
Hi, my name is DJ Valentine. I'm one of the three co-hosts of the Simplistic Reviews podcast. You can find us on simplisticreviews.net. We're kind of, how would you put it? If a regular podcast is the news, we're the Daily Show. So we're kind of like we take jokes, we make sketches, we play games. We don't take ourselves too seriously. We kind of... perform blue. If that's it's not for children, but yes, we do have fun, and we enjoy each other's company. So essentially, we were friends that we would talk movies all the time, and then one of us, I think it was Justin, decided to push the record button, and that's how the podcast came about.
And all this time later, you're still friends after
still
podcasting
friends, still
for
friends.
So long.
Well, I mean, Matthew probably has a hit out on my life, but it's okay. It's fine. I understand.
Well, and I admit, one of the things that I do appreciate about your show is that you don't take things too seriously. No. It's it is just as
How
much
dare
a
you?
Comedy
I take
podcast.
Everything
you know?
Super serious, okay? I'm super serial. I'm always serious all the time.
Well, considering the fact that I got to appear on the show, not as myself, but as the great Gonzo, goes to show that it's not something to be taken all that seriously.
I was playing that sketch for a friend of mine literally last week, and I was like, yeah, we did a Sesame Street sketch. And his comment was, who's Gonzo? I'm like...
you're making that up.
I'm not going to reveal my sources. I said, I flew over to New York. I know a couple people in Sesame Street, you know, they kind of gave me a little hookup.
I mean, where do these things come from? I mean,
the
you
sketches?
Know.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, because, I
place.
Mean, they are all over the place, yeah. And it's a wild ride, and I love that you've gotten other folks involved and that I've gotten to be involved, you know, just in a small way.
I'll tell you how the Sesame Street sketch came about. It was, I think we recorded that, or at least I think I wrote it during COVID times. And during COVID times, everybody was out of work, so I was watching a lot of... Not documentaries, but behind the scenes of the mafia.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, the mafia's in New York. Sesame Street's in New York. Now maybe you should make a mafia sketch of the Sesame Street, and that's essentially how that came to play, to pass.
I thought you were going to say that you've been watching documentaries like Being Elmo or the Big Bird documentary.
I was watching like behind Al Capone's greatest, you know, crimes and capers and Lucky Luciano. I was like, well, the mafia, the La Cosa Nostra, Sesame Street. What's the difference? That's kind of how that came to play. Yeah. And now we're doing for opening March, we're doing a Dune sketch. I just finished recording it. This is our second Dune sketch, and I will be editing it right after the show. So yes,
I think Dune keeps coming up on like every podcast I've been recording recently because people are so looking forward to Dune Part 2.
Sometimes I make sketches because I'm not a fan of the thing I'm making fun of, and sometimes I make sketches because I cannot wait for the thing. So Dune, I was like, I gotta do a Dune sketch because Dune Denis Villeneuve's movie looks like probably the best movie of the year already. Yeah, I cannot wait to watch it. So yeah.
So you were probably seething last year when the strike caused another delay of this.
Get me started on how angry I was when I found out. I found out it was going to get delayed probably before anybody. I helped run a movie theater. So they tell us like ahead of time, like, yeah, we're not sending you guys the hard drive for the thing because it's not. What do you mean? What are you talking about? And they're like, yeah, because it's going to get pushed because of reasons. And I was like, no, you're telling me I got to sit with. I don't even know. Aquaman, I got to deal with it. Give me Dune. I want Dune. So finally, hopefully we'll all get to watch Dune, and I will sit in my theater, probably maybe a couple days before everybody else, by myself.
Come on.
My legs up. Yeah, I'm going to use my flaunt in this and go, yes, give it to me, Denny. Give it to me.
Now, do you get that weird popcorn bucket that I keep on seeing on things where it's got like you're reaching into the sandworm?
Thank goodness. That is a different theater than ours. We saw it. We're like, are we getting the weird sex toy Dune bucket? No, we're getting very boring stuff. I'm like, thank God. Thank, I don't want anything having to do with that bucket. I don't get that. Yeah. Keep that bucket away from children and me. All right. Keep that thing away from me.
There's a part of me that was like, should I get this thing just so that I can look back, you know, and go,
if you get it, you're on a watch list. If you buy that, you're automatically put on some kind of watch list, some kind of website will have you on it. Do not purchase that. Kids, do not purchase the Dune book. Watch the film. Enjoy the film. You will be good. Do not buy the Dune bucket. It is abhorrent. Why they made that thing.
So now I got to ask, though, do you have an appreciation for the David Lynch film from 1984? Because they're re-releasing that as well.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. It's funny. The people I work with are very younger, and they're not aware of the because they've seen the newer one, and I'm like, this is like the tamest. Not say tame, but like Dune is weird. I go, you don't know weird. Watch David Lynch's Dune. You want to see weird. Denis Villeneuve was kind of making it palatable for, you know, general audiences. David Lynch doesn't care if you can get it or not.
No. Every time I watch David Lynch's Dune, I'm like, and to think what we could have had in Return of the Jedi.
Can you imagine what the Ewoks would have been doing if David Lynch was in charge of an Ewok? They would have probably had five eyes walking around like spiders. Speaking in French, it'd have been crazy if he was. It would have been insane.
Oh boy! Well, speaking of crazy and insane too, I the thing that always draws my focus when I'm looking at your podcast episodes is the commentary tracks that you do. Because I mean, you're doing commentary tracks for movies that I mean, seriously, nobody else is doing, including the people that made these films.
Exactly.
I mean, you know.
We're doing a service here because they decided not to make a commentary, so we decided, let's make a commentary for your film. It's funny, when we first started, we were doing like movies we love, like Die Hard and Lethal Weapon, and now Justin and Matt made an edict, like, no, these movies are too good. We just end up like watching it. We're not talking, so we got to just keep our baseline at bad. We just did a commentary, which will probably be released by the time this is, because we're in the future, in honor of the late Carl Weathers, we did Action Jackson. And we could always tell a commentary maybe halfway through where we're like, this might be too good for us because we're watching it. So we're like watching Action Jackson. We're joking. And then like halfway through, we're like, man, this movie's almost too good for us to like do the commentary. We're usually doing like, you know, chainsaw hookers from Mars and all types of weird stuff. So
the fact
that we're doing like legit movies is usually a rarity. Or, you know, we'll do like a Hallmark film just to, you know, just to make fun of it. We like, it's funny because our commentaries are completely unscripted. So, and we're basing it kind of on MST3K, Mystery Science Theater. And it's, we don't know where they're going to go. We don't know what we're going to talk about. It's usually just, if you ever watch, want to hear a legit, just general non, because our sketches are scripted and we overproduce the show, the regular show. The commentaries are just off the cuff. We don't know what we're going to talk about. There's a drinking game somewhere in there. Matt is doing betting for some reason. We're Vegas. It's crazy. But yes, I really enjoy doing the commentaries because I don't have to write anything. I don't have to edit anything. Yeah,
absolutely. Is there any time with some of those films that you are talking about there where, like, you're going in thinking, okay, this is something that we're just going to riff on and it's going to be wild. But then you're like, oh, there's actually, you know, this is a real gem here. I mean, like, you know, the Velocipaster suddenly becomes this, you know.
We picked Velocipaster by name only, but that was pretty bad. We follow Andy Sedaris films a lot, Hard Target to Hawaii.
And of course you should. I mean, yeah, come on.
Me and Justin were doing one of them. And Justin is a huge James Bond fan. And we were doing, I think it was Fit to Kill. And we're watching it. And like 20 minutes in, we're riffing. And we keep looking at the villain. We're like, God, we know this guy. He looks very familiar. And we're like, wait a minute. Is this guy related to Roger Moore? It's Roger Moore's kid. And we're like, what? So we were like, this is the greatest movie of all time. We must watch every movie this man does. And we did.
Every now and then, someone shows up in one of those Sedaris movies. Like, Pat Morita's in one of them.
See,
you know?
I was like, what's his name? I think Oddjob was in one of them.
Yeah.
There's always like a weird James Bond connection. Like, wait, I think Andy Sedaris is us. I think he was like, I want to have Roger. I can't get Roger Moore. Fine. I'll get his kid. I'll get his son. I'm going to win this somehow.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a famous son in the movie we're talking about today, because Chris Mitchum is in it, too. Let's get on to this movie we've got here today. It's called The Last Hard Men, released in 1976. This is directed by Andrew V. McLaglen, which should be a familiar name to listeners of this show, because we literally just talked about another one of his films a few weeks ago. He directed Fool's Parade, which we discussed with Richard Kirkham.
Awesome.
Just a few episodes back. And, you know, I mean, we've had it where we've discussed multiple films by the same director before on the show, but not this quickly. And this was not planned at all. This was it just happened this way. But, you know, he's basically a journeyman director, known especially for directing Westerns throughout the 50s and 60s. But here we are in the 70s. So the genre was much different than it was when he was doing a lot more Westerns. You mentioned MST3K. I mentioned this last time we talked about one of his films, but I'll throw it out again. He directed the film that was featured on a very famous episode of MST. He directed Mitchell, starring Joe Don Baker.
Say less.
So this film, it's also it's based on a 1971 novel called Gundown by Brian Garfield. He did an uncredited rewrite on the screenplay for this film. But, you know, he was involved in a couple other films. He wrote the screenplay for Hopscotch with Walter Matthau, which was based on his novel. He also wrote the 1987 horror film The Stepfather, starring Terry O'Quinn. But probably his most notable contribution to the world of film is that he wrote a little novel called Death Wish, which, of course, was adapted into the 1974 Charles Bronson film and spawned, what is it, 4 sequels?
Yes, many, many. And a remake with Bruce Willis.
One other behind-the-scenes name we got to throw out is that there is a credit at the beginning of the film for composer Jerry Goldsmith. But, you know, that is a little bit misleading for all the fans of the maestro here. This score was actually originally composed by Leonard Rosenman, but it got rejected. And so then they turned to Goldsmith, and they basically cobbled together bits of music that he had done for 4 other films and came up with this. So,
okay, this is all making sense now, but continue.
Anyway, so this film, it takes place in the Arizona Territory, 1909. It begins with a dramatic and violent escape by the members of a chain gang who are working on the railroad tracks. The leader of this escape is a vicious half-Indian criminal named Zach Provo, played by James Coburn. And after killing the two guards, he selects six of the most dangerous prisoners to accompany him, and then he lets the other prisoners all go their own way. And of course, these other ones, they all get captured or killed pretty quickly because they're not as savvy as Provo and his friends. Among the men that Provo has with him, we have a Mexican gunslinger named Cesar Menendez, played by Jorge Rivero. There's the slovenly Will Gantz, played by John Quaid, and a 19-year-old kid, Mike Shelby, played by Larry Wilcox, the year before he would start starring on Chips. Now, word of Provo's escape eventually reaches a retired lawman named Sam Brigade, played by Charlton Heston. And this is exactly what Provo wants. Provo's only desire, really, is to get revenge on Brigade for putting him in prison years ago. Now, Brigade is a relic of the Old West, and this is now 1909, so the world is changing. And that causes him to clash a bit with the local sheriff, played by Michael Parks. Still, they think that they can lure Provo out with a load of cash that is going to be coming into town from the Denver Mint. Provo's a bit smarter than that, though. He ends up, while they are going to meet the train, he sneaks off and goes and kidnaps Brigade's daughter, Susan, played by Barbara Hershey. Presumably after she stopped calling herself Barbara Siegel. She went by that name for several years. But anyway, they then head out into the wilderness with their captive while Brigade pursues them with the help of the young man who has been courting Susan, Hal Brickman, played by the previously mentioned Chris Mitchum. Things then proceed to get pretty brutal for all parties involved as Provo and Brigade finally face each other. This is definitely not the sort of Western where we have people just flop onto the ground when they get shot. This one gets pretty bloody, but I'm going to let DJ get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on The Last Hard Men.
You were mentioning it earlier. This was not on purpose. You gave me like a list, and I looked at the poster, and then I was like, okay, I see Heston, Coburn, Western. Yes, please. I'll have a bit of that. And then as the credits were rolling in, just like our commentaries, I go in cold. I don't want to know anything. I just looked at the poster, and I picked that. So I didn't know anything about the movie. I didn't look up anything. I just want to watch this cold. And I see the credits. I'm like, oh, Barbara Hershey, Michael Parks, Jerry Goldsmith, which is apparently fake. Robert Mitchum's kid? Because I didn't know it was his kid yet. I saw Mitchum. I'm like, maybe it's not Mitchum. And later, by looking at him, I was like, okay. But I was like, oh, this is going to be all right. I'm in for a good time. And after watching the film, the sentence I found myself saying aloud was, man, that was dark.
Yeah.
Throughout the first act, I got an Unforgiven vibe where I thought they were going to go where the bad guy may be the good guy and the good guy may be the bad guy, at least morally anyway, just because of what happened to Coburn. But then the certain scene happens, and I was like, oh, okay. Never mind. The bad guy is really the bad guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I dug it, and I dug the prison escape. It gave me little shades of Peckinpah with the blood and stuff. I was like, okay, we're gonna get some stuff here. But man, I did not see the third act going the way it did. It caught me off guard. Like I was like, okay, then this is gonna happen. Because I'm in my mind when I watch movies, I'm like trying to fill in the blanks, and I was like, nope, that's not gonna happen. Nope. I'm not going to get into the scene. I'll let you do it if you want.
We will eventually, yeah.
Yeah. Certain things happen where I was like, wow. And then I was very, I don't want to say let down. I was like, huh? No, what?
Yeah.
Give me a title card, something. The film kind of just stops. And I was like, oh, this. One, how have I not heard of this movie with Charlton Heston and Coburn before? And two, how could you in this climactic fight like this, it kind of just ends. And I think you could have ended it in a way, this is me trying to fix a movie that's probably made by smarter men than me, just ended it in a way where it's more final, and it kind of leave it open. And I was confused by that. I was like, this seems like you could have ended it by just changing one line near the end, and it would have been fine. It's just, wow. Again, I like the movie. I would recommend it to people just because I want to see their reaction to the third act.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah,
no, I agree with you. It's a roller coaster ride of a movie because you think it's going to go one way,
right,
and it doesn't. The tone shifts here and there, and when it shifts drastically.
Really,
yeah. You know, but yeah, I mean, it definitely did not end up being the type of film I thought it was going to be. I mean, you mentioned Peckinpah, and you know, clearly this is a post Wild Bunch Western,
yeah,
because it gets pretty brutal and bloody and downright mean too. I mean, it is just nasty, and it sets that tone from the very beginning. I mean, the escape of the chain gang, I actually would say it may be one of my favorite scenes of the film, and it's right, yeah, at the beginning. And you know, it's pretty clever, and then it just gets really nasty with where it goes. I mean, like I say, we don't shy away from spoilers on this show. We're talking about a movie that is, you know, 50 years old. Okay, you know, closing in on that. And so, yeah, we'll give stuff away. The opening escape, Coburn is kind of faking his way through working on the tracks and has an excuse to flop over, and he grabs one of the railroad spikes. And I was kind of thinking, all right, you know, stabs the guy with the railroad spike, guy, you know, keels over, and that's that. No, he like slams that thing. Like, I did he even toss it?
He vampires him.
He does. And the Peckinpah blood and all that. I was like, oh my, this movie is something different than what I expected. And then he blows a big hole in the other guard.
Right.
And I'm just like, ooh, this
I was in. Yeah. I was like, oh, let's go. Let's do it. I'm in. Because at that point, I'm like, the first thing that popped in my head was Peckinpah. I go, Peckinpah, okay. Am I post-Peckinpah, Eric? Because I didn't look at the date. And I was like, all right, we're going to get some good action, which we do. And I was just like, all right. And stuff starts happening. And I think it's a head fake because I can't remember when they give Coburn's backstory. I think it's like during their escape on the train with the meat.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, he's kind of in the right for what he wants to do. And then there's a later scene where they're at a general store, and he like protects the public, kind of. And I'm like, yeah, he's kind of I'm getting a William Money thing from him. I swear, the thing is probably Unforgiven. He's the sheriff. Like Heston's probably like a jerk, and whatchamacallit is the, you know, whatever. And then it's just like, oh, this is raw. That third act, you gotta understand, I like paused and I was like, wait, did I miss? I thought I missed something. I thought the copy of the movie I had was missing something. That's how drastic of what that happened, because later they kind of act like it didn't happen.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'm like, this movie came out when? You could do that in movies like that back then? So yeah, that third act is the Dusk Till Dawn moment for me. It's the twist that I was like, whoa, okay, all right. I guess we're in that. I guess they really, it seemed like a studio note, like, we got to make Coburn bad. Like, we got to make him really bad.
Well, let's not beat around the bush. I mean, let's go ahead and jump into the violence here. And I mean, kind of the key moment that we're kind of skirting around here, we'll bring that up. But I mean, just in general, the approach to the violence in here, because it's not just the big moment we're going to talk about. It's not just the railroad spike. It goes throughout here where there are some really, you know, moments that catch you off guard with the degree they go with the blood and all this for, you know, 1976. We look at it with 2024 eyes and got, you know, you could probably still go, yeah, that's kind of tame. But looking at this in the context of 50 years ago,
right?
Yeah.
I didn't think we were going to get the accused in the West. That's what I didn't know was going to happen. That confused me. I was like, whoa, wait, what year is this? And I'm probably glossing over what I really liked. I love every line Heston is making a meal of this movie. I think he just took the movie because all of his lines are just great. When he's like talking to Michael Parks, give me all of that. I loved all of that where he's kind of like the retired lawman. The setup is great. I love the setup. I kind of wish it was more of an ambiguous confrontation, but near the third act, it becomes not ambiguous. Coburn is evil, but even if he has a right to be, if the evil act that he performs is just so evil, it makes it sway so toward Heston, where I think the movie would have benefited if it was more, he's right, and maybe Heston, your sloppiness led to this horrible situation, and then you have that confrontation of just men's wills. That's what I thought we were going to get. But no, nah, they went right to, you know, you know. So
I like the way that you described it as it, you know, the accused in the old West. I mean, that's the nice way of saying it, I guess, because, you know, basically, like we said, they've got Barbara Hershey's character in tow here. And, you know, there's hints all along that, you know, these guys have been in prison. They haven't seen a woman in ages and all that. So, you know, you know, they're just, you know, giving her looks and all that stuff. And you're like, okay, a lot of films hint at that kind of thing, but don't go as far as this film goes. And that moment for Coburn is that he, at one point where he's on a mountaintop and Heston's down in the brush beneath, and, you know, Coburn's trying to draw Heston out because he wants to gun him down. And so he sends Barbara Hershey out there, tells her, go, run, go ahead and escape, and then sends his guys who are woman-starved out to get her. And they do. And it's a very uncomfortable scene to watch. I mean, it goes a lot farther than I thought it was going to go. And, of course, the thing that is the most difficult about the scene is that, you know, Heston has this thing to deal with. If he goes out and does anything about it, he's going to get blown away. And it's actually Chris Mitchum's character who's the one who stops him. Heston's ready to go out there, and Chris Mitchum's like, no. And he actually like bops him over the head with a stump or something like that. And makes it so that he can't, cause he knows he's going to die if he goes out there. And yeah, it's just for all the places that this film goes leading up to that, there are some violent moments leading up to that. That is just, I mean, that rips your guts out.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here, and this is, again, must be on purpose, because they head fake you twice. When Coburn stops the guy in the general store, he stops him. He stops him. Mm-hmm. But then you realize later that he stopped him because it was making his partner, Menendez, uncomfortable. And then,
and I think he stops him too. I mean, he says a line, something about like, well, I'm going to get you all you want later on. And
it gives him
this, you know, this idea, it puts this idea in your head that this is his plan all along.
Yeah.
Just makes Coburn all the more vile. You know,
because the second time, there's that scene where she escapes Wilcox, and I was like, are they going to go here, where it's like a Stockholm syndrome thing, where he recaptures her, mm-hmm. and he's kind of like coming on to her a little bit. And I was like, are they going to go here with it? It's like, nah, he doesn't do anything. But he kind of stops. I think Wilcox stops. He tells him not to do it.
Right.
To tell Wilcox to protect her. So they head fake you like a couple times that he's not going to – he's trying to – it's not about her. But it's because he wanted to save it, which is even worse.
Yeah. And I did appreciate that they don't go that direction where you turn Larry Wilcox into the love interest for Barbara Hershey. Right. That would have been really, really awkward. Which, I mean, on the one hand, it's like, okay, that's Larry Wilcox. That's John from Chips. Yeah. He's a good all-American, clean-cut guy. I had trouble even dealing with the fact that he was supposedly this 19-year-old kid who has a life sentence in prison. Because I'm like, what would Eric Estrada think? Come on, that's John.
That's Joe Football over there. He's like yeah. the most clean-cut guy you've ever seen ever in anything. And you're like, okay, he's a – I think they say his record, but I missed what they said, what he did.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember.
Be really bad because he was in there for life. I think it's because he might have done one of those mice and men sort of situations, because he seems a little slow. And I know,
but he's good with a gun. I mean, there's that. There is that scene where he's, you know, telling the other guys that Coburn told me not to let you guys at her, and the one guy's toying him with it, like, hey kid, you know how to use that gun or what? And then he shoots his ear off.
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of skipping around, but I think we needed more with him, because when they have the candy canes fall out of his pocket,
Oh, yeah.
I go, did they earn this? I was like, he wasn't a bad performance, and it was a good character. I liked it. It's like, man, I think I needed more time. I think I needed more with him, more of a backstory with him and Coburn, because you're speeding through to the revenge part. I don't know if I needed a flashback or something. I don't know. Maybe because I'm greedy. I like more stuff. But in the novel probably gives me everything I'm looking for. But yeah, I did like that character. I thought there'd be maybe a scene near the end where she was going to like tell... She does stop Heston from shooting him, right? And then later, what's his name?
Mitchum shoots Mitchum, him. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Because I thought she was gonna like try and protect him because you know, as a, you know,
he's the one guy that was kind of good to
trying
her.
To you know do. But the thing about Heston, seeing what happens to his daughter, getting knocked out is worse. I think Heston would have probably just taken the L and it'd been better because if he would have got killed. Then she probably doesn't get attacked.
Mm-hmm.
It probably ends there. And he doesn't, because Coburn literally doesn't even look at Barbara Hershey as anything other than a means to an end.
Well, so, Coburn looks at everybody in this as a means to an end. I mean, when
yes,
throughout the film, he's got these guys he's gathered around him. But once their usefulness wears out, he eliminates them. I mean, there's the one guy who, I'm forgetting his name, but I mentioned him. He was in the last film I talked about from this director. What's his name? Robert Donner. He plays the guy that leads them to that store that they go to. He's the one who's I don't take orders from anybody. That whole thing, and
it's time. It's time, guy. I like to call.
Yeah,
I like that part.
And I mentioned him on the when we talked about Fool's Parade because when I see his face, I go, he was on something. He was on Mork and Mindy occasionally when I was a kid. He played Exidor, which was this weird character that used to always show up and be weird with Mork and whatnot. But anyway, so, once he's done, he's led them to this store. They've gotten all the stuff that they need. They got new boots, new guns. Larry Wilcox stuffed some candy in his pocket. And, his usefulness is done. So they blow him away. And, that's kind of Coburn's thing through this whole movie is he's got a set purpose for everybody that he pulls into what he's doing. And once he's done with them, he's going to remove them from the picture.
I think it was kind of what – I think that was – The one kinship I thought he had was with the Spanish guy, and I think
Cesar
wanted to kill that guy, so I don't think Coburn actually cared at that point. But Cesar goes, I think it's time, and he goes, okay, yeah, you can kill him. He's nothing to him. Like I don't think Coburn had any ill will to him. Like you're saying, you're just a means to an end. Like once Cesar asked me to do it and I didn't need you. Yeah, you can do whatever you want. But I didn't before. He was like, no, I need him to get to a certain point. Mm-hmm. And now Cesar is telling me to kill him. All right, fine. He's so cold throughout this movie to a point that I didn't think. It reminded me of Payback with Mel Gibson, and he's in the movie, and Mel Gibson shoots his luggage, and he's like, that's just mean, man. That is you the entire movie. Coburn just being mean for everyone around you.
Congratulations on bringing up Payback, the second episode in a row here. That's amazing. The dynamic between Coburn and this guy Cesar, it reminded me a lot of the dynamic that you've got between Michael Biehn as Johnny Ringo in Tombstone. Cesar reminded me a lot of Johnny Ringo. And then Coburn reminded me a bit of Powers Booth as Curly Bill in that. They even dress similarly.
I was sitting there like, Coburn, you're trying to hide in the mountains. You're wearing a bright red shirt.
The bandana around his neck and the whole thing.
You might want to wear something a little less conspicuous. You stick out like a sore thumb. But yeah, Powers Booth also wore the red shirt. That's funny. I didn't think about that. He has one of my favorite memes of all time, which is, well, bye. Which I love Tombstone.
I love everything about Tombstone. Tombstone is fantastic. Well, I mean, while we're talking about the criminals here, I guess, we've spent a lot of time on Coburn. We've mentioned a few others, but there's a bunch of them. I mean, who stands out for you among this motley crew of criminals we've got?
I liked Wilcox. I think there was a story between him and Wilcox that I wanted to see, because he kind of protected him, too, a little bit, at least in the beginning.
Mm, yeah.
But again, even with, is it Sanchez? What's the name of the guy? the Mexican guy when he gets.
Oh yeah, Cesar Menendez. Cesar is his name. Yeah.
Yeah. When he dies, it's like he doesn't care. Like it's not even. I thought he would have like some kind of reactionary moment. He was, you know, nope. His revenge. I guess this is like the whole moral of the story, kids. The moral of the story is revenge will just overtake you to where even your closest friends are nothing to you. To where it leads to your ultimate destruction. That was your Sesame Street PSA of the day. But no, I like the little dynamic he had with him, because he kind of like tells the kid, hey, kid, watch the girl. And then when he goes, oh, I was trying to get some sleep, and he kind of like smacks him around. But it's like a big brother, little brother situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like that relationship between them. And I did like him in Cesar too, because I like the part where he's like, gun, like during the escape, where they seem like a Butch and Sundance kind of situation, like the partners.
Yeah, yeah.
But when Cesar goes, it's like it's not even like a hint of, oh darn it, he didn't care. It's all about Heston. I gotta kill Heston. That's it.
What one of the ones that I liked was played by actor John Quaid. He plays a character named Gant. And he's the guy that you probably recognize this guy from a bunch of other things. He was in a bunch of Clint Eastwood movies. He's one of the bikers in like the Every Which Way films and that. And he's just got a memorable face that looks like it got bashed in with a shovel a couple of times, you know. But he's just this, you know, this grimy, slovenly guy. He's one of the nasty guys that goes after Barbara Hershey at one point. But, you know, he's just got that slimy look to him that makes him just a great Western thug. Yeah,
perfect casting. When they shot his ear off, he looked better, put it that way.
Well, we spent a lot of time on the villains. We should talk about our heroes. I mean, Heston, I guess, I don't know. Some people enjoy Heston, and some people, Heston is an acquired taste. And I think here, you know, if you're put off by Charlton Heston kind of doing his thing where he is making every speech feel really important, and he's like looking out into the distance. I mean, think about the scene from Wayne's World. Is it one or two?
I think it's one.
Where it's like, can we get a better actor?
Get a better actor in here, yes.
And he does this breathy thing, you know, as the service station guy. I mean,
I knew a girl who lived on Bleecker Street or whatever the heck he says. So good.
I mean, that's Heston's performance through this whole movie.
You know what I appreciated? Because Heston is Heston. Like I said, he's making a meal of every syllable. Him and William Shatner. Have they done a movie together? We got to look this up.
Oh, I'm not sure.
The movie's like 19 hours long, because it's just them just taking their time, just saying every word. And I bet you a 10 of those lines are cut. Like, I liked everything Heston was saying because it was so over the top. But I appreciated that Michael Parks was not against him. Like, he would, in a lesser movie, he'd have been like the guy, like, you're wrong, Heston. I'm not going to, you know, I forget. What was his real a character's name? I forget.
Brigade. Brigade is his
name. You're wrong, Brigade. Like, he would have been against him. But, like, when Brigade tells him something, he appreciates his experience and does what he says. Except for when they get to when they're out of his jurisdiction, essentially. But when it comes to doing things, when Brigade is telling him, he isn't a, like, antagonist. He understands. He knows what it's about. Mm-hmm. He's the first to help him when his daughter gets kidnapped. I appreciated that, because I've seen so many movies where that Michael Parks character is the annoying character that the main character has to, like, man, I'm trying to, you know I'm right. Why are you not helping me? But yeah, and it's Michael Parks, who is great in everything.
He's great. Yeah, he's great in this. He is one of my favorites of this film. I love the dynamic between him and Heston, because I mean, really, one of the running themes through this film is the idea that this is at the end of the Wild West. You know, this is 1909, and so the era of the Western and all that is coming to an end. You've got the telegraph, you've got cars, and that they got telephones. And Michael Parks' character is this laid back sheriff who has kind of got this attitude like he doesn't need to actually go out there and get on a horse and chase the bad guys anymore. You know, hey, we got a car. You know, these guys can't outrun the telegraph. You know, that whole kind of thing. And there's this wonderful scene where we're first introduced to Heston, and he's talking with Parks, and Parks is literally like sitting back there at his desk, almost with his feet up on the table. And Heston's laying out all this stuff and talking about all these criminals. He knows all these criminals. He, you know, probably remembers putting half of them behind bars and all that stuff. And Parks is just kind of like, oh yeah, you know, we'll get them. And it's just like a great dynamic, you know, such opposite ends there going on. And eventually Parks kind of comes around and is, you know, going with Heston on things and that. But at the same time, he's still kind of like, dude, you're a relic. You know, there's new ways of doing things.
He's like Watson if Watson was lazy. 'Cause Heston's like breaking down. I bet you that ice is melted. He's like breaking down the things that he can't even possibly know. And Parks is like laid back, like, yeah, you know, maybe you're right. Send a guy over there. Like, he's very casual. Casual would be the best way I could describe him. He's super casual lawman. Like, he's wearing, like, not a cowboy hat. He's wearing, like, a fedora. He's, like, he's super casual lawman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Even the scene where, you know, he eventually kind of turns things over to Heston's character, where Heston's kind of like, can I go and go after him? You know, you want to give this to me? And Parks is just like, all right, yeah, you know.
Sure, whatever. <Nah. laughs> Hey, somebody give him a warrant, I guess. I don't know. What do we do? Paper? Whatever.
I want to jump back to you real quick about just that concept of kind of like, you know, that this is the end of the West and these guys in this story are, you know, a relic of a different time. I mean, I mean, that's got to be where this title is coming from, The Last of the Hard Men. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it applies to both Heston's character and Coburn's character. You know, they're using their old methods in a world where, you know, they're out of step with it now. I mean, like, one of my favorite scenes that's an example of that is where they're in that general store and Coburn gets spooked because the telephone rings. He doesn't know what a telephone is.
I love that moment because he like he just starts shooting up the store. What is that noise?
Yeah,
what's going on? I did like that. I was like, that's a good attention to detail because he wouldn't know what a phone was. He's been in prison for God knows how long. And the phone is pretty much a new invention. He's like, somebody from like seeing a DeLorean go back in like 1920. Like, what is that thing? What is that device? The spaceship or something. But no, I did like that. Coburn is evil incarnate in this movie, but he's really good. Coburn's always really good, but he's doing stuff in this movie where I'm like, man, Coburn.
Well, yeah, I mean, it says a lot when you can be this vile in a movie and you're still the most charismatic character of the whole
thing.
I was
rooting for him until, you know, the scene. So I was like, yeah, you got it wrong. I think Heston accidentally, according to him, the Coburn probably doesn't know that, killed either his daughter, his wife, or his girlfriend.
I think his wife, yeah. His wife? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah. He didn't really I didn't hear the specifications of it. So at that point, I'm like, okay, John Wick's mode. I'm like, yeah, Heston, you got it coming. Heston even knows. I got it. He tells his daughter, I got it coming. This guy's coming for me. I am expecting it. I probably deserve it. He doesn't really say I deserve it, but he has this demeanor.
No, I think he does. Yeah.
Like, okay, good.
I don't think he says it, but I think he feels that way because right. I think in some ways you could make the case that part of the reason that Heston even goes on this thing, even before the daughter is kidnapped, is that he sees this as being like his chance to go out in glory. You know, he's been retired for a few years. He's bored. He doesn't fit in this world anymore. And here's a chance for him to go out in a glorious way.
Do you think Bridges kind of, I wonder if Jeff Bridges seen this when he was doing Hell or High Water. 'Cause there's a lot of similarities between him.
You could be right.
In that character where it's like, this is kind of the last hurrah for him. And like, he's very good at his job, but he's not like overly romantic about it anymore. I like that whole thing about maybe because I just like Heston, but I liked how he was very matter of fact about everything. Like, yeah, he's going to come here. He's going to try and kill me. Da, da, da. Like he could have been using bravado and he wasn't. He was very, you know, a realist to the situation.
Yeah.
Which goes against a lot of Western tropes. This is a very especially because of the scene, goes against a lot of Western tropes that I've seen before. So yeah, not a lot of good guys are riding off into the sunset in this movie.
Well, that seems as good of an excuse as any to talk about the ultimate ending of the film here. I mean, once we get that big pivotal scene that we talked about, and we're already in a very uncomfortable place. Then we've got to see how things, finish off here. And I mean, we literally have a fiery conclusion of things. I mean, Heston sets the side of a mountain on fire, basically.
He burns down the country.
And again, talking about the level of violence in this movie, one of the bad guys goes out where he's, gets shot.
In the most brutal death I have ever seen. He's shot and then burned alive. That's horrifying.
And we see the aftermath, too.
I'm like, it's funny because when he got shot, I didn't consider it. And then it started happening. It's like, oh, no. Oh, this is bad.
It's Revenge of the Sith. I mean,
No, but see, Anakin was just near the fire. This guy is engulfed in flames.
Well, and then we get, a lot more shooting, lots of folks gunned down. Larry Wilcox goes out, which is a bit sad.
Mitchum kills him cold. Mitchum, I think the part of Mitchum is he is probably more cold than Heston. He allows what happens to Barbara Hershey to happen, and he kills the most sympathetic villain in the movie without a give a crap in the world. Does not get cold-blooded. I was like, man, maybe that was their point where it's like Heston's kind of trying to, even against better odds, I'll run out there and save my daughter. It's my daughter. And Mitchum, who I don't think we've mentioned, is the fiance of his daughter?
The suitor,
Let's it happen. So near the end, I was expecting Heston to say to Hershey, he's a good man or something like that, but he doesn't say that. And I was like, yeah, he probably can't because, I mean, he is, but he went too logical. He did it like how Spock would handle the situation.
Yeah. Well, then we have the ultimate showdown between Coburn and Heston. It doesn't turn out well for either one of them, but I guess give me your take on this ultimate conclusion. Does this satisfy you?
What was Heston's plan? I didn't understand. Well, he does say it earlier. He says he'll hesitate. So when he was essentially, Homer gets a drop on him, and I guess he decides, screw it, I'm just going to run, knock his gun away. But then Coburn, training days him, shoots him five times.
It's brutal.
It's all maiming wounds. And that's what Heston was. He says earlier that he'll take his time with me. He won't kill me quick. He'll blah, 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 blah. So because he wanted, I guess, Coburn, who is half Native American, wanted to scalp him, it appeared. That gives Heston the opportunity to finish him off. But then the movie was we're out of film. Can we just do a box wipe real quick?
Yeah.
Just get rid of
Hershey and Mitchum come in there to help him, And I'm going, they're out in the middle of nowhere. We're fading out. The credits are going to roll. Die. Oh, well, that's the thing. I really thought the ending of this was going to be Heston was going to tell Hershey to go off and get him some water or something
there.
Like that. Yeah.
He knows where the money, or at least they know where the money, the gold or whatever. Live your life. I'll die here. It's fine. Nobody will ever come after you again. Live your life. No.
I thought, though, that he would send her off and leave Mitchum and tell Mitchum to kill him, to end it for him.
That's even darker. Ooh, I like that, too. that's even dark. Ooh.
But yeah, while it's an exciting finish, that end beat just leaves you hanging. And
it feels
it's just
they went to commercial break at the end of the movie. Like, we'll be back after these messages. It's
We now join, the NFL playoffs already in progress.
Where's Heston? Show me Heston. Yeah. Where is he? I think your ending or my ending would, because it sets it up okay, he's gonna die here. He's gonna have at least one more woman with a daughter. I'm sorry, blah 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 blah. Live your. That's what I thought they were, but they could have put a freeze frame and a title card, anything. The movie just is there an after credit sequence? I stopped. I don't mean they do a Marvel thing. No, make Fury come out and say that we're gonna talk to you about the Avengers Initiative. Anything happened? What happened at the end of this movie?
We're going to talk to you about the Sam Brigade Initiative.
Sam Brigade Initiative. My name's Wyatt Earp. I want to talk to you about Tombstone Initiative.
Well, we should start moving to the break. But yeah, any final thoughts you have on this one? I mean, you've been on the show a few times where we've talked about Westerns. I know Yes. You've got a thing for Westerns. I mean, how's this satisfy your taste for Westerns, I guess?
I'm glad I watched it because I try and scratch off as many of the old ones as I can that I have not seen because I've seen so many. And the fact that this is a movie starring Charlton Heston and James Coburn, and I had never even heard of it, fantastic. I think I might need to read the book. I have a feeling the book doesn't just have a torn out page at the end. Maybe they give me some kind of denouement of what happens. So yeah, I like the movie. I would recommend it just to watch it because you're going to get prime Heston. You're going to get really good Coburn. You're going to get some good action. Just in terms of finality or closure, you're not going to get any of that.
Just be prepared. And be prepared for it's not your squeaky clean kind of Western. Oh, this is not one you watch with the kids hanging around. It's rough. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who the f*** that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, art house gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and like people who feel like my weird way can like get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast. And on Twitter at @cinema_recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more, and we thank you for your support.
Hey, let me interrupt the current podcast you're listening to so we can tell you about Musically Ignorant, hosted by me, Jason, and my pal Lackey.
Hi, I'm Lackey.
We discuss all kinds of music from mainstream pop acts like Ben Folds and R.E.M.
and very obscure acts like Cabaret Voltaire and Black Moth Super Rainbow.
I think you just made those names up.
I most certainly did not.
Well, I guess that's why we named the show Musically Ignorant.
Indeed, you rapscallion!
Now, before Lackey turns too much into a 19th century professor, you should check us out on Anchor, Spotify, Apple, Google, or our home website, rabbitholepodcast.com.
Jason, have you ever heard of this Lizzo person that's trending on Twitter?
Oh man, I got my work cut out for me.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to share about another movie that we've enjoyed, something we want to let everybody else know about. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic. It could be something new in theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, DJ, what is your recommendation?
Well, I have been traveling over the past month, so I got to see a bunch of films, two really bad and one excellent. I'll go over the bad ones real quick. The Meg 2. I was riding the high of The Beekeeper, where I was like, oh, this movie is really better than I thought. So maybe that, no, it wasn't. Meg 2 was awful. I couldn't even finish that theoretical statement. And then I saw Argyle, which the best description of that movie would be, it feels like Matthew Vaughn's wife made him make this movie, which I think is fantastic because it's so.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah. It's like, it's literally like a self-insert housewife movie. And everybody involved I like. I love Henry Cavill. I love Matthew Vaughn. I like Bryce Dallas Howard. I like Sam Rockwell. I like Bryan Cranston. Everybody in the movie I like. And then sometimes you get that and it's not good. It's not a good movie. Just stay away. The movie I saw flying back to Florida on the plane, and I was just like, eh, whatever. I'm going through the list and all of this, which was an excellent film. Is a movie called Blackberry. I don't know if you've seen this movie called Blackberry.
Oh, no, I haven't gotten to see this yet.
Stars Glenn Howerton and Jay Bruchnell. It's about the creation of the phone, the Blackberry phone. It is the closest thing I could come up with. It would be like a Wolf of Wall Street meets The Big Short, but about a phone, essentially. Glenn Howerton, and I kept, you know, you hear those things where people tell you somebody's good in something. You're like, oh, okay, sure, they're good in something. And then you watch, you're like, whoa, they weren't kidding around. Glenn Howerton should have got an Oscar nomination for this movie. He is so freaking good as this character. What would I compare it to? Kevin Spacey in Swimming with the Sharks? It's like high levels of, holy crap, this guy. And it's so not him. If you watch Always Sunny in Philadelphia, he's kind of like, you know, the pretty boy crazy guy on there. You know, Charlie Day or McElhaney. He's this megalomaniacal business shark who does not give a crap about your feelings. He's fantastic. And I think the great Michael Ironside shows up for maybe about 20 minutes. He's great in there. Jay Bruchnell is very good in it. A lot of people show, Carrie Elwes shows up occasionally. I would recommend it just because I had a BlackBerry phone. And I didn't. I remember all the little, because I'm old, I remember all the little, the rise of it. And this, I did not know of the details. I won't spoil them here of how it got to be and how it got not to be. I did not know about that stuff. But I would recommend it for Glenn Howerton's performance alone. It is, and I'm not even head faking, Oscar caliber performance. Maybe, you know, I compare it to a better example. He's like Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast. He is unhinged because it's such a character turn for an actor that you see him do stuff and you're like, yeah, he's hilarious. But then you see him do this and you're like, wow, this is completely not what I thought I would get out of this character. He's so good. So, so good. I would recommend Blackberry. Watch it, watch it, watch it. If you watch Argyle, make sure you did not pay for it. You watch it on TV. Same thing with Mike, too.
I've been wanting to see Blackberry. It's one that I've seen the trailer several times and gone, yeah, I want to see that. And then it keeps on drifting from my memory.
I kept missing it too.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, there were a bunch of these movies this past year. I didn't hear it talked about a lot, but like 2023 was the year of these films centered around some kind of a product, you know, because you had Blackberry, right. You had Tetris, you had Air, which Air is one of my favorites of the year. I really like that a lot.
Tetris is also good, by the way. Tetris is also a good movie.
Dumb Money, which was not so hot, but, you know, kind of interesting. I liked the one about the Cheetos. I don't know if you saw Flaming Hot about
I gotta look that up. Somebody had mentioned Cheetos. It to me, and I haven't seen it. I'm going to probably look it up. I'm putting it on my queue.
But, yeah, I mean, it's the weird trend of 2023 to do all these films about different products in our lives, and Blackberry definitely looks like one I want to check out. So, yeah.
You will enjoy it, I promise. You will enjoy it, I promise you. I promise.
Well, the movie I'm going to recommend, I was really struggling to come up with something this time around. I was looking through stuff I watched in the last month or so, at the end of last year, and trying to land on something. And finally, I hit on something. I was like, okay, this kind of fits because we're dealing with some elements of revenge. We've got a guy that is trying to get revenge for some bad guys that have violated a woman. Or I think in this case of this movie, I'm going to recommend several women. it's got some Western elements. And our lead character is also a half Native American. So I'm going to go to 1967 and The Born Losers, which is the first film to feature Tom Laughlin's character of Billy Jack. And of course, he would go on to play Billy Jack in three more films after this. I've actually seen the second one many years ago, which is just called Billy Jack. And I really enjoyed this film. But I hadn't seen The Born Losers, which is the first one. So I finally got a chance to look at this one. I basically, at its heart, it's a biker film. It centers around a biker gang called The Born Losers. And they are terrorizing the folks of, like, Monterey, California area and you know, doing all kinds of nasty things. And this guy, Billy Jack, is this Vietnam vet, former Green Beret. He just wants to live a peaceful life, you know, out in the wilderness and all that, communing with
Rambo
nature,
settings.
That.
Rambo,
yeah,
John Rambo settings.
You know, but he can't, you know, he's just the kind of guy that can't let evil prevail. And it actually, right at the beginning of the film, he intervenes at one point where when these bikers are roughing up some folks, and he ends up being the one thrown in jail. Billy Jack's doing a good thing. He gets thrown in jail. And so, you know, this leads to some various other things. And eventually Billy Jack is out and he's got to, you know, take care of things. He's got to get his revenge on these bikers. He's got to clean up the town. I mean, it's got a lot of the elements that you love to see in a biker film. It's got a bunch of colorful characters in it, some great fight scenes, a lot of cool motorcycle action, all that. But really, I mean, it's all about Billy Jack. He's just such a cool character. And I can see why Tom Laughlin, you know, kept bringing him back. I mean, Tom Laughlin just clearly, he seems to connect with this character. And he goes, I mean, I've only seen this film and the second one. There's two more after this that I got to get to yet. But in the second one, Billy Jack goes to some weird places. He's like, you know, doing weird rituals with snakes and all kinds of stuff. And I'm just like, this guy is just the coolest thing, you know? So I
cool so, rituals with snakes. I'm in.
So I was thrilled to see more of Billy Jack here, to see his origin in this film. I'm anxious to see the other ones. I think in one of them, he like, you know, runs for Congress or something like that. I mean, bring
I don't
on
know which
more
one,
Billy
I don't know
Jack.
Which one I want to see first, the snake ritual one or Billy Jack runs for Congress. I want to see both.
Yeah, the four films are The Born Losers, which is what I was recommending here. Billy Jack is the second one, and then The Trial of Billy Jack, and then Billy Jack Goes to Washington. So,
please
yeah.
Please tell me you made up that last title. That's not the real
no,
title.
No, that is legit. Yeah.
Perfection.
Well, DJ, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all the stuff you got going on.
I'm on Twitter under trying to be DJV, or you can check our website for the Simplistic Reviews podcast. Let's go to simplistic.reviews, simplistic.reviews, or to search Simplistic Reviews on YouTube. You can find all our weird commentaries and our weird sketches on our weird show. And then sometimes we ruin history. Sometimes we do Simply 15 where we talk about stuff. And then, you know, sometimes we just lose our minds for about 2 hours. So yeah, check that out.
Excellent. Thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that's going to bring us to the end of this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read other reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. We welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so feel free to email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And while you're at it, please consider leaving us a positive review over on iTunes or wherever you download the show. And then don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again real soon.
What's that? This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.